Welcome to Steppin' Out of Babylon, produced by Sue Supriano. Babylon is everywhere. It's the isms and schisms not only within the system, but within ourselves. Let's unify, stand aligned, and step out of Babylon. Everybody, my name's Sue Supriano, and I'm really happy to be talking today with Frances Moore LePay. Frances Moore LePay wrote Diet for a Small Planet. Wow, that was a book that had a big effect on my life. When did that book come out, Frankie?
Exactly 30 years ago, uh-huh. 1971.
Uh-huh. And that book talked about all the reasons not to eat meat and gave recipes and was politics and recipes. And food politics. And then she started Food First also. Now she lives in Boston, where she's a senior fellow at Second Nature. And most recently, she's written a book with her daughter, Anna. So it's Frances Moore LePay and Anna LePay, who have written Hope's Edge, The Next Diet for a Small Planet. And that's what we're going to be talking about right now, because the book is—I haven't seen it since it hasn't quite out. But I heard you speak about it. It consists of your travels all over the world.
Yes, the idea for this book actually originated with my children. I have a son also who's 30, and they sat me down 2 years ago in a bar in New York and said, "Mom, our generation needs a diet for a small planet. That we are so distressed about the news we're seeing of the world, which just, we see the deepening inequalities, we see the increased devastation of nature, but primarily the mainstream media is telling us that there are no other paths, that this corporate globalization, the path we're on, is it. And our generation needs a diet for a small planet, a book like that to help us make sense of it all, and we'll help you do it." Yeah. So I couldn't say no. I mean, how could I say no? So soon after that, we got underway, and my daughter graduated, I would say, from research assistant to co-author very early in the process. And our goal for this book was really to help people see what is emerging that is very promising, that can take us beyond corporate globalization as we're experiencing it, where more and more and more of life is reduced to a commodity for sale, and where poverty, the gap between the rich and poor, is accelerating and widening, where nature is more and more and more being destroyed. So where are there signs that we can go beyond this? And where are there signs that we can re-embed, in a sense, economic life into community values, into other ways of not just reducing everything to a commodity? Mm-hmm. So we were on 5 continents over 7 months.
Yeah. Well, I have to tell the audience that your daughter is now the same age, 27, that you were when you put out the first Diet for a Small Planet. And I saw the two of you speak at the Bioneers conference a few days ago and was just so moved as a parent and as a person to see you two together and know that it's not just that you're doing this work, but that you're doing it together. And I often feel like I don't see why people aren't activists as much as they can be, especially because they have children, although it can be for all the children. But when we really also have children, it just makes total sense. And I would like you to talk about those travels that you were talking about. You get back to the travels around and what you learned and where the hope is. Mm-hmm. I want to say that we've also been talking about we're here at the in the middle of October and just talking about this really terrible, terrible situation that we're in the world, and how your book really fits with that. So feel free to tie that in, too.
Well, this book has changed me forever. I mean, the travel, the journey. We traveled, let me just list the countries we were in. We traveled to Brazil, to Kenya, to India, Bangladesh, to Western Europe, to Poland. And then there are two chapters in the U.S., one here in California and the other in Wisconsin, in Madison, Wisconsin. And in each place, let me just tell you a little bit more about the book before I go further, that the chapter begins with what we call maps of the mind. And really the thesis of our book is that human beings can only create what we, in a sense, expect will emerge out of the dominant worldview, and we call it the mental map, and that every era has a mental map, and human beings operate within that. We breathe it in like an invisible ether. It's very hard to identify, and we're convinced that the dominant mental map is killing us, and that is why we are creating a world with such devastation that you or I or nobody would choose. I mean, how many people would get up in the morning and say, yes, today I want to make sure that several thousand children die of hunger this day, or we want to get up in the morning to extinguish a few species. I mean, clearly something is happening on our planet that none of us feel we're choosing. And we feel, Anna and I have concluded, that the reason that we don't feel that we're choosing it is that we live within this mental map where we're told that this is all there is, and so it feels like nobody's really choosing. So we talk about this mental map that we identify five thought traps within the mental map. And basically, in the interest of time, I won't go into it all, but fundamentally things that we all experience every day, that we're told that we human beings can be reduced to this caricature of ourselves, that we're only selfish materialists, that we're only accumulators and shoppers, and that with that understanding of ourselves, then this corporate globalization that is the dominant way of functioning today in the economy, we're told that that is the only path because that fits our basic nature of being so selfish and so materialistic. So what we did is we traveled to places that are breaking free of that dominant mental map, showing that this is a very, very destructive way of understanding life on the planet at this moment. And so it was very concrete. This book is very concrete. It's all stories. It's our experience of going, say, we hiked into the foothills of the Himalaya and sat in tiny villages where people are saying that the Green Revolution, the chemical approach to agriculture, doesn't work for them, that they are reclaiming, gaining confidence in the traditions of organic farming and seed sharing and seed diversity that sustained them for centuries. And they are, in one village, for example, we saw beautiful books that were being created registering all of the specimens of all of the plant species in this village, because they're aware of gene patenting as part of globalization today, is the patenting of life, including seeds that have been part of people's traditions for millennia. So they're creating these what they call bioregistries, which document the heritage of these villages, so that if the corporation were to come in and say, no, we are intent on patenting this, that there's now precedent that this would protect them, having recorded their own biological heritage, that this would protect them from the gene patenters. And we just sensed the emergence of people willing to acknowledge that life does have more meaning than simply accumulation, and people listening to that part of themselves. We traveled to Brazil. Now, when I wrote Diet for a Small Planet 30 years ago, the prospects for land reform in Brazil seemed absolutely nil, because peasants who had attempted to take advantage of all of this idle land, you know that in Brazil, landholding is extremely concentrated. But most of the large landowners only use a tiny fraction of the land. So since I wrote Diet for a Small Planet 30 years ago, what has emerged is absolutely astonishing to me. Now, 250,000 families have settled on 17 million acres of land as part of the landless laborers movement. And they are creating communities and asking, what kind of crops do we want to grow? What kind of schools do we want to create for our children? What kind of cooperatives and workplaces do we want for ourselves? And this shift in, instead of feeling just victims of these large, what they call, what they describe to us as the neoliberal model. Now, these are people with a fifth grade education sitting in these shacks against the wind. Only they had black plastic sheets were the only thing protecting them from this very cold Brazilian winter. And explaining to us that they believed that there was something more life-serving than the neoliberal model, which they said just focuses on export agriculture, heavy use of chemicals, cut back in government services. And they said, no, they said that approach does not really take into account the needs of the individual. It was really interesting. They said, capitalism doesn't care about the individual, which was so funny because here in the U.S., we think capitalism is all about the individual. So we sat with them in their villages, and we saw the kinds of schools, now 2,000 schools they're creating for their children. And they said to us, well, we're teaching our grade school kids philosophy. And we said, grade school kids philosophy, it just didn't seem to make sense to us at first. And we thought, well, maybe they're talking about some kind of Marxist indoctrination. So we said, well, what do you mean by that? And they explained that to them, that meant that they are teaching their children not to accept the world as it is, as a given, and to ask themselves, what kind of community do I want? What kind of settlement do I want here? What kind of Brazil do I want? And this was just the most moving experience of sitting with these parents who themselves had grown up landless, and many of them had been abused by their parents because they lived such desperate lives and would take out their rage on their families. And then the consciousness that they're having, this landless workers creating communities to try to really do things very differently. Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess that's what so many people refer to as empowered.
Yes.
And in thinking critically, thinking, that's wonderful. I would like to know, I want you to tell more stories, Frances Moore LePay, but I also am curious about what you think is the thing that gets people to do that, to be, since there's all these people in the United States using the word about we must get empowered and all this. I wondered if you'd come to any conclusion about, and if you haven't, that's okay, about what that's about.
I have strong feelings about that question, and that's why I helped start a news service that lasted for 5 years called the American News Service, because I believe so strongly that we human beings are social animals. We learn from each other. We mimic one another. We learn what's possible by what we see around us. And why I'm so distressed by the state of major media today, because they show us such a small slice of who we are as human beings. And so what we're doing, Anna and I, in writing the book in this way and telling stories of people who are stepping out and saying, I can be a co-creator of my future. I don't have to be a victim. Then they are showing other people that's possible. So we're hoping by telling these stories in our book, and we're doing everything possible to get our book into the hands of people who wouldn't ordinarily read about these topics, that people can say, oh, I could do that. Mm-hmm. Oh, that sounds so exciting and enriching, that how can I apply these lessons to myself here in my community? And so we also include examples of industrial countries. And in fact, we tell the story here in the Bay Area of the edible schoolyards, where teachers and administrators and students are creating, instead of having asphalt playgrounds, they're creating schoolyards that are gardens in which children not only plan the garden, plan what crops they want to grow, grow them and harvest them, but then they prepare the food and serve it to one another. And so this link to the earth is very empowering to them to see what they can create. So I think that how do we experience it? I think we the most important choice we make in life is who we bring into our life, who we let in, who we welcome in. Certainly that's so true of a spouse, but our close friends, our co-workers, because we become each other. I'm really convinced that we take on the characteristics of people we bring into our lives. So we want to bring new people into people's lives, and that's why that there's such amazing people in our book. I think of Wangari Maathai in Kenya, who in 1977 planted 7 trees to fight the desert, and now through a network of village nurseries, all run by village women without a formal education, they have now planted over the last 20 years 20 million trees. And she has suffered great attack from the Moi government. She's been jailed. She's been beaten. And yet you meet her through our book, and her spirit is so strong, but so contagious, so contagious. If you see, and she tells a story in the book about her childhood, about learning that life is all about continuing to take the next step and always going to the next ridge. And she tells a beautiful story in the book that calls sort of each of us to realize that we don't have to have, you know, the entire answer ourselves. None of us do. But we can all step outside of our comfort zones, so to speak, and look for people who will support us in taking risks. And I think that is the key. To recognize that very few of us can take risks utterly alone. So we need to bring people into our lives who will cheer us on as we go into our comfort zone and experience fear. I think one of the key pieces of our book is to acknowledge the reality of fear that comes when we take risks and really make it acceptable to talk about fear. Because I've experienced a lot of personal fear in the last several years. And it's so sensitized me because I haven't had to face jail or gunfire like the people in Brazil. I've learned that it's okay in our society to talk about burnout and stress, but it's still very shameful almost, or it's just not very cool, you know, to talk about fear. And I think now, particularly after September 11th, so many of us are experiencing fear. And what Anna and I learned is that fear doesn't have to stop us. Mm-hmm. Fear can mean we're at our growth edge. And if we acknowledge it and we accept it, and it doesn't have to stop us. I mean, in the process of writing this book, I experienced such terror that I wouldn't be able to complete it, that I wouldn't know what I was doing, that I was just stepping out into the unknown. And yet, I realized that I didn't have to have it all figured out, that I didn't have to get over my fear. I could just walk with it, and then doors start to open. And this is one of the most powerful lessons in our book, that you don't have to have it all figured out, and you certainly do not have to overcome your fear in order to be effective. And you can just begin wherever you are, whatever your passion is. So there was a lot the book is really this journey, but it's also just about people's experience of what it means to take risks, because we live in an era where so much change is required of each of us, and change is scary.
It sure is. Well, I've certainly been experiencing and thinking about even more than ever just exactly what you're talking about, and I totally agree. And it is scary, and it's really, we can do it anyway, and looking into myself, whether I'm going to keep my mouth shut or not in these times, which are potentially even more oppressive if we don't stand up. I just know that I couldn't live with myself if I didn't do it, and I feel scared, and I want to urge other people to really take a stand, because that's the only way I don't know if it's the only way, but it's certainly an important way to make a difference, really. And we better do it, because things are moving fast.
Things are moving very fast. And I feel that my sense is that the events of September 11th, the horrible shock and the tragedy of that day, is an opportunity, in all of that pain, is an opportunity that is unprecedented in my lifetime, in the sense that we, it's so easy for us to see how wrongheaded it is for people to believe that flying an airplane into a building of human beings is going to serve some higher end. It's so easy for us to see how, what's wrong with that belief system. And so I think seeing that so clearly then calls us, if we listen, to think about, well, what is it in my belief system that is condoning that which it should not, or justifying loss of life now towards some other end? What is it about the world that you and I live in every day that accepts 37,000 children dying every day from hunger and hunger-related disease? It's this, it's a death that's not as dramatic as the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. But nonetheless, it reflects a belief system that says, okay, well, we can accept that because that's the way our system works. It's not everybody can buy what they need in the marketplace to feed themselves. Well, on our trip, we met people in the city, for example, of Belo Horizonte in Brazil, who said, no, this is the fourth largest city in Brazil. And it said, no, we won't accept that anymore. We won't accept the notion that if people simply can't buy food in the market, that they starve, that that's part of our belief system that we must make obsolete. And they said that food is a right of citizenship in the city, and have completely reoriented dozens of ways how they are making food available, good, healthy, organic food available to everyone. So that's what I mean, that things that we take for granted, perhaps this moment, this shock, this shattering moment, can allow us to look at our belief system and decide that which is intolerable.
Yeah, really. Well, and oftentimes we think those things are so far away, those of us who have food. And of course, it wasn't as dramatic for, it's not as dramatic for children to die, but it's every bit as horrible. I'm not telling you, obviously, you this. I'm supporting Francis Moore-Lepay, what you're saying here, because there is a way in which too many people in the United States value, or I guess that's part of our mental map, as a country, to value the American lives and not other lives, or certain American lives and not other American lives. Racism is often very mixed in there too. Mm-hmm. I want to get you too off the track.
No, this is, I don't think we're off the track at all. And I think that another key part of what is so out of whack in our world today is highlighted again by the tragedy of September 11, that the perpetrators of that terrorism are also part of a system which is so oppressive and oppressive to women, but also excluding women from decision making, which I believe is so much part of why we have such misery in the world today, that women's voices are excluded. And on our journey, one of the things that we focused on was precisely that. In Bangladesh, for example, we highlight there, we sat with women borrowers and owners, slash owners of the Grameen Bank, which is a microcredit program that is now being spread around the world. But this was in a country where women were not even allowed to speak to men other than their immediate family. That what has arisen in the last 20 years is a bank in which women are actually the owners and the borrowers of over $3 billion that have been loaned through this bank to 2.4 million Bangladeshi women. And certainly we saw there the potential for women to, and the actuality of women gaining more voice in their families. And now through this microcredit program, they are giving housing loans only to women so that women gain title to their homes. Because in Bangladesh, until very, very recently, a man could divorce a woman simply by saying talak three times, the word for divorce three times. And so there was this threat always hanging over a woman's head that if she didn't obey, that if she didn't submit in every way, that she could be homeless, just thrown out of her home. And now, through this microcredit program, women are gaining title to their own homes, and men are going to think twice. But I think that this is another dimension that is brought to light by the tragedy of September 11th. What happens in a world and in societies in which women are denied a voice, that this is a loss to all of us. And this is what we try to bring out in our book, examples of women gaining voice. Women have such powerful roles in these emergent communities. For example, I mentioned Africa, Kenya, where this powerful woman who planted trees and then believed that village women could plant trees, even though the foresters all told her, no, it takes a forester to plant trees. Mm-hmm. So I think this is another key part of the lesson here.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have not too much more time left. Maybe for another quick story, Frances Morlepe, or if you want to just say what's in the Hope's Edge is the name of the book, The Next Diet for a Small Planet.
Yes, and I would encourage you also to visit our website, dietforasmallplanet.com. And I just want to say the last chapter of our book is called Traveling the Edge of Possibility. And there we take all of the lessons from the book that have emerged from the real lives of real people and show how they are creating a more liberating mental map. In other words, we're arguing that human beings have to have a mental map. I mean, we are creatures of meaning. We have to have what Eric Fromm called a frame of orientation.
So it's sort of like culture in a way.
It is, yes. It's another way of saying that. But we've reached the point, hopefully, of human evolution where we can be conscious of what the mental map is and we can throw out what's not working. And a key part of the dominant map today is that we've reached the end of the road, that corporate globalization is the culmination of human history. And what our book shows through all of these stories is that people are making the path. They're not looking for a new ism. They're not looking for a new formula. They're not looking for an end point of history. But they believe that we can just keep on being creative together in community. Mm-hmm. And I want to mention also there are 100 pages of delicious recipes contributed by the greats who have created the Whole Foods vegetarian cuisine since I first wrote my book, including Molly Katzen and Alice Waters and Laurel Robertson and Anna Thomas and Annie Somerville and other chefs of great restaurants around the country. So our book is to appeal to all the senses because we still believe that we can sort of follow food and unravel the complexities of economics and politics.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you're certainly doing a great job of that, and we all got to have food. There's no doubt about that. And get Frances Moore LePe and Anna LePe's book, Hope's Edge, The Next Diet for a Small Planet. It'll be out in February?
Yes, it'll be out late January, early February, yeah.
So look for it. Okay, thank you so much, Frances Moore LePe.
Thank you, Sue.
My name's Sue Supriano. Thanks for listening.